This is the State of Things broadcasting from Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio. Reverend Rob Lee is a descendant of the Confederate General Robert E. Lee and an advocate for social justice. He's confronted his own white privilege and actively works toward the goal of racial equality in spite of his family's history. Rob spoke out publicly against racism at the MTV Video Music Awards in 2017, and it was soon after the death of activist Heather Heyer at Charlottesville at those protests.
My name is Robert Lee IV. I'm a descendant of Robert E. Lee, the Civil War general whose statue was at the center of violence in Charlottesville. We have made my ancestor an idol of white supremacy, racism, and hate. As a pastor, it is my moral duty to speak out against racism, America's original sin.
These public comments in some ways cost Rob his job as pastor at Bethany United Church of Christ in Winston-Salem. It's just one of the stories that Rob shares in his new memoir, A Sin by Any Other Name, Reckoning with Racism and the Heritage of the South. Rob, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Take us back to that decision that you made to appear on the MTV Awards. First of all, how it came about and why you decided to do it.
Well, it actually occurred because of NPR. The president of MTV and some of his vice presidents listened to NPR, so good on you guys. And they heard this and they said, we've got to have Rob on the show to help confront what is going on after Charlottesville. And so my wife and I got this call, and it was, we didn't think it would be as life-changing as it was. We didn't think it would be as costly as it was. We thought it would be a free trip to LA to confront some things that needed to be confronted. Yeah. But in spite of that, when we got back, we were met with hostility. We were met with death threats. We were met with a church that did not agree with where I stood. And that was one of the hardest parts of my young life, is confronting that kind of reality.
But it was hard for you. You talk about in your memoir the difficulty and you having second thoughts the night before your appearance. What was going through your mind? What were the fears that you were having before you actually appeared?
Well, my fear for this has never been for me. You know, I know people are going to go after the person who is saying this stuff. My fear has been for my family, for my wife. What would people think? And I know that sounds kind of trite, but if we're all honest with ourselves, we wonder what people will think of us when we stand in a time of trial and say something that needs to be said.
So you did it, and now you talked about the fact that you were met with hostility. This is in the church. What kinds of things? What were you hearing when you came back?
Well, Frank, the first interview that I ever did with you was 3 years ago, and we talked about faith in institutions. And since then, I've lost a lot of faith in institutions. But I haven't lost faith in the people. I haven't lost faith in the people that matter to me in those institutions like the church. I see beauty there. I see beauty in the people who are going to church every Sunday and confronting racism, because it is the most segregated hour. And that's what we came home to, was a segregated hour. And we had to decide, my family and I, what was best for us. And what was best for us was confronting this head on.
Were you surprised that in your church, which has a reputation of being a little bit more progressive on the spectrum of Christian churches, there was a kind of reaction, and you were met with the kind of statements that you heard when you got back?
Well, Frank, I'm afraid white people are going to be white people. I mean, we've got to confront that in our own realities, no matter how progressive we think we are in our progressive circles of faith or wherever we are. We're going to have white privilege and even white supremacy, dare I say. So what we have to acknowledge is that these situations are most unfortunate, but the real reality that we need to be confronting is not who's in the pulpit. It's how we're confronting those realities together.
Well, it seems to me that the challenge is the phrase that you used, white privilege, because so many people feel that they've earned everything and they have worked very hard. And particularly if you're working class, and some of the people out in our rural areas, white people in rural areas, do not feel the least bit privileged because of what this political economy has done to them over the last several decades. The way it has absolutely ravaged their communities and extracted wealth from their communities. And they don't know what hit them. But saying it's about race makes it a lot easier than trying to explain some of the complicated economic theory that's really bludgeoned them.
Well, I don't want to deny that feeling. But what I do want to deny is the reality that there might not be a system there. There's a system at play. Even the poorest white person has a system that is advantageous to them over people of color. And we have to acknowledge that, whether that works for us or not, because, you know, unfortunately, I come from Appalachia. I'm Piedmont of North Carolina. We've seen poorest of the poor in those areas. But that doesn't deny the fact that white people have a systemic advantage over people of color based on from the very foundations and even before that of this nation. I mean, we're marking the 400th anniversary of the transatlantic slave trade in 1619. We're having to acknowledge these things, and it may be hard, but it is necessary.
As you say, it's hard because it's under the surface, it's everywhere. How does it show up? What do you mean by that? All right, slavery, 1619, it ended in the middle of the 19th century. It's over. There is no more slavery. Why are we still talking about that?
Well, Jim Crow didn't end in the 19th century. And as Peter Story, who was a bishop in South Africa and later a professor at Duke, would say that racism has gotten into our drinking water and we're drinking it once again. You see that in so many ways in this culture, even today. We never killed Jim Crow. We didn't have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission like they did in South Africa. We passed the Voting Rights Act. Dr. King died. We thought we were done. And now we have to face that. And one of the things I try to do in the book, along with Bernice King, who wrote the foreword for the book, the daughter of Martin Luther King, is say that we have to do this together or we won't do this at all. We have to confront these ugly realities. We have to seek reconciliation with God and with one another. And we have to work together for a future filled with hope.
Yeah, but there's been a kind of political genius that's working in just the opposite direction, that's making sure that people don't work together, because once they all see what's really happening, a very few people are privileged by this, and they don't want everybody to get together and overturn the system. Given the fact that they have been so successful in driving that wedge, do you really see any hope that people can actually come out from under the spell of racism and see what's really happening in this country?
Well, I'm not one who particularly likes systems, whether that was from when my kindergarten teacher, who's here today, said that, I would ask her, well, where were the bones from all the people that died after the flood?
That's your prove it moment.
Prove it for me, right? You got to prove it for me. My own ordination journey, yeah. I have been one who has bucked a system, and I think that we're going to have to buck some systems in our own reality, in our own culture, to see a better tomorrow.
Now, the way in which the sort of the tenacious grip that people have on this memory of the Confederacy, what do you think accounts for that, and why is it so difficult to let go? No, let me ask it a different way. You're a descendant of Robert E. Lee. Was there a moment for you where you realized you had to confront this? In other words, were you the beneficiary of it? And did you like the fact that you were a Lee for a while in your younger days?
Well, I still like the fact that I'm a Lee. I think I don't mind it. I'm not mad at my parents for naming me who I am. What I am mad about is what our culture has done with the name Lee. We have made him into an idol of white supremacy. I refuse to believe that anybody is all bad. There had to have been some good in that man, and I'd love to have dinner with him one day in heaven or wherever, and figure out wherever I'm going, and figure out get to the bottom of what he was thinking, because I do think that there is more complexity to all of these situations, whether we're willing to admit that or not. And so for me, one of the things that I did reckon with as a child was having a Confederate flag in my bedroom. And it took a woman of color, a strong, faithful woman of color, to encourage me to take it down and to say, if you're called to ministry, that flag is incompatible with your call to ministry.
Right. The very first time she did that, what went through your head?
Oh, I was ashamed. I was ashamed of the reality that I had had a flag that would somehow hurt her, because she was so important to me, because she had been so important to our family.
Now, what you hear over and over again is not about white supremacy. This was about states' rights. This was the legal right of states to say, we don't like what's going on here, we're going to secede, and you came down here and took away our right to secede. Had nothing to do with white supremacy.
Well, it was the legal right to own slaves. That's what we're talking about when we talk about states' rights. People need to finish the sentence. They need to see that it was states' rights to own slaves and to enslave people. This is not, we're not talking about cattle. We're talking about people. You know, there's a difference in how we view this, how we weigh all of these issues. And these are not just about issues. These are about people and the descendants of people who are hurting. And so we have to do something.
Christianity made its peace with slavery more than 400 years ago. It is complicit in the slave trade. It supported and justified, and through some kind of theological jujitsu, actually sanctioned slavery. So that's a long time in the making. How do you undo that?
I think of people like John Newton, who realized and recognized, even in the midst of what he was doing, the wrong that was there, and instead offered a different way. I think of people here in North Carolina like Presiding Bishop Curry and William Barber, who are offering us a different way of doing things, of doing church, of doing life, of borrowing that Easter message and translating it for our time and our place. Because, you know, if we are an Easter people, if we just celebrated Easter, then we need to get up out of our graves, whether that be of chattel slavery or of Jim Crow South, and face tomorrow with hope.
Yeah, but again, my question is, do you see it happening? Because there is a theology that justified slavery and continues to justify Jim Crow. In bedrock dogma and theology, it's there. You don't have to buck the system or pretend you're not religious. You can point to your religion. It was used from the pulpit to defend slavery. Is that being undone, and how do you undo that? There's a whole faction that says it's absolutely right that we did it, and it's right that we continue. And we're Christian.
I think the part about being a big tent Christianity is saying that there are different portions of our faith that we disagree with and we have to fight. There are people in my faith that, you know, I may agree more with an atheist than I do with an evangelical Christian, that's for sure. But what I have to acknowledge is that it is through love and by love and in love that we try and confront that reality and change it for the better.
You, Bernice King, you mentioned that the daughter of Martin Luther King Jr. wrote the foreword for your memoir. What was your relationship with her, and how did you sort of get all that to happen?
I am one of the luckiest people on earth to get to know Bernice King. Bernice invited me to speak at the King Center for the MLK celebration and later participate in the 50th anniversary of the commemoration of her father's assassination a few years back. And I found it incredibly remarkable that a woman decided to invite a man who was a descendant of slave owners, and she, a person of color, into the same room for the same purposes. She talks about that in the foreword, that she was skeptical of that. She didn't know how it would go over or how it would go down, but it's actually been a beautiful friendship and a beautiful relationship in which we've found more truly what it means to be a Christian, but also what it means to confront the issues of our time together.
Now, the first time you and I talked, it was about a book that you wrote before this book. This is your memoir, A Sin by Any Other Name. That's your latest. But before, you wrote a book about bringing millennials into the church. And I talked to you a long time and questioned you a long time about whether there's a need to have a church, whether the institution itself had outlived its purpose. And what millennials were telling you was, we'd like to have a spiritual life without a church. And you defended the institution, I thought, eloquently and vigorously. How do you feel about it now? And does the church, qua church, as church, have a role in this? Or do we have to go outside the institution to make it work?
Frank, you didn't question me. You grilled me.
I give you a hard time.
You did. You pushed me pretty hard there. I think about it this way. There are some days that I gave up church for Lent. I'm a pastor. I didn't go to church for the entire 40 days of Lent. And I found God outside of the church. But let me tell you, Easter was all the more beautiful when I came back, because God was still there. In the brokenness, in the mess, in the people, in the diversity, and then sometimes even in the workings of the lack of diversity to change that, that's where God is. And I don't think, you know, we could argue all day about institutional brokenness, mm-hmm. but the real reality is that there are people that are hurting that can use the church, that can use sanctuaries, like we heard in the last piece, that can use people of faith for the good in this world.
And there is an institution that does have this message, and it's been a powerful message for millennia, two millennia, for that matter. And so a lot of it is already there. You don't have to reinvent it. You talk about voluntarily putting to death that which is toxic in you, and having the faith that once you kill what is deadly in you, that life form, a new and more powerful life form will take root. But it is an act of faith. In these times when people are so anxious and frightened, what do you see happening? I mean, I know you've talked about the potential for this to happen. Where's the movement? Which direction are we heading in the moment? Are we still walking up Calvary, or are we about to be laid to rest?
One of my friends, Weston Matthews, is pastor at Grace, the Plains in Virginia. And my wife and I went, and they actually had us stay in the room where Robert E. Lee stayed in before the Battle of Manassas. I mean, that's how integrated the church was, and the church members were, with this reality of the Civil War. And yet they wanted to talk about something different. They wanted to talk about Charlottesville and how they could be a hand of help for those in need who are still recovering from Charlottesville and the events that happened that day in August of 2017. And so I see hope there. I see hope in these progressive communities of faith coming together and saying, look, we have been this quiet voice, but now we need to find our voice and be a little louder for the sake of a better tomorrow. I mean, these are things that we can focus on and celebrate. And we've got our bad stuff. We do, Frank. But we can move forward into God's unfolding future with hope. And that's really what we need to focus on.
There must have been people that came to you with and also expressed gratitude and said, thank you, I've been trying to figure out a way out of my own, you know, nightmare and trap for a long time. Did you have that sort of thing?
We all have our pasts. And I think a lot of people are trying to get through their pasts. And I want them to know that that's possible. And I'm not some woke, quote-unquote, individual who's suddenly with it and got it. I mess up. But at least I'm trying. And that's kind of the point. That's kind of the point of faith.
What are you doing now? We talked about the fact that you, in fact, resigned your ministry at the church. But it was under pressure. It was while all of this was happening. What have you been doing since, and who have you been talking to?
Well, I just finished teaching 2 years at Appalachian State, which was a wonderful experience. And now I'm on book tour, having a wonderful time talking about this book, talking about what it means to me, and finding a new way and a different way of addressing these issues.
I wonder if people are doing it, because if you think about the foundation of this country, it is founded on slavery, is based on that. We capitalized ourselves. You know, the wealth that we have was generated by those folks. And I think there's a big fear that if we acknowledge that past, we're going to have to, not only will we have to give up our privilege, but we're going to have to give away something that we have, and we don't want to acknowledge how we got it. What do you think it would look like? Do we have to pay, you know, reparations? Does it look like going back over the deeds and seeing who really owns this land? What would it actually look like if we sat down and confronted our past in an honest, and in your case, in a Christian way?
Well, I want to preface this by saying I'm a white person, so I can't really address the full issue of reparations. But I think about it this way. You know, I could say, sure, here's a cash sum. You can have my student debt too. This is the reality that we live in, right? This is a painful reality. But what I think is far more powerful is me coming to a person of color and saying, look, I'd love to talk to you and hear your story. I'd love to hear the story of how you have found God amidst the mess, of how you have found God amidst the pain. And then taking that story and not speaking it for myself, but projecting it, as I tried to do in the book with the stories of Janie and Mother Aileen and Miss Bertha, the characters in my life who needed projection for their sake. And so now their stories are committed to posterity and for posterity's sake. And that gives me a great deal of hope.
Reverend Rob Lee is a preacher and the author of A Sin by Any Other Name, Reckoning with Racism and the Heritage of the South. Rob, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Just ahead, we're going to talk with a ghostwriter who finally got to put her name on the cover, but first the banjo music of Andy Eversole, who's going to be playing as part of the Banjo Earth Band at the Carolina Theater in Greensboro on May 25th. Andy.